coming up. So with that, I mean, it's not like a screenplay. You know, on the other hand, with a screenplay, you have millions of people seeing something that 99.8% of the time only faintly resembles anything you intended to say. And with a theater, you have 50 people a night seeing exactly what you intended to say. And to me, that's important. Three reasons occurred to me about why I do this as I was thinking about it in the shower, which is where I do all my things. That and in the car. If I had a shower in my car, I would create great works of art. There are three reasons, and I think three is a mystery. It's always a three. Comedy comes in three, set up, punch. You know. I had a Methodist minister tell me once that all Methodist sermons can, you know, in three parts. You could preach heresy if you preached it in three parts. But some of these occurs. The first reason is I still believe that theater is one of the only places where you can do whatever the hell you want. You can create any form, and because you're producing it, or because it doesn't have to be produced with a $35 million movie budget, you know, and all of those things, right? You can do the wildest, most outrageous things, and the other people will do them. Even if you don't produce it, people, it's not like people are risking millions of dollars or their careers to do this, so they'll do it. You can get away with so much more creativity in theater. I still think it's the most creative art form in the world. The second reason, what was the second? Why do I like to do this? I remember the third reason. Let me check my reasons. I actually wrote them down. The paper's a little wet because I was on the camera. Oh yes, absolutely. Well, the third, it's the second one I forgot, but it's because we've already talked about it, which is the immediacy of it. I don't have the patience to wait for years for something on. If I finish a play, within a month, it can be up. And I don't have any patience. These are personal things, by the way. These are not things I'm recommending you feel, or even suggest you feel. Some of you would, I know people who have spent years on a six-line poem and then hope it'll get published someday, but I am much more of a gonzo playwright than that. I mean, I like the idea of getting it finished and getting it on and then seeing what it's like with the collaboration of the audience, because that's your other collaborator. Without an audience, you got some... Somebody once accused us in Atlanta of trying our plays out on audience. Unfinished works on audiences. And I examined that after I, you know, dismissed them and belittled them for it. Of course, I realized they were right. And, so what we did was we turned our theater into a workshop theater. We got National Endowment money to do it with the idea that all of our plays were unfinished to some degree. We would get the audience response, have audience discussions. Beware of audience discussions. And then it's different in college. But out in the real world, who cares what they think? I mean, I don't mean that. I'm really an audience-oriented person. I love the audience, I trust the audience, but I don't want them to have to verbalize stuff. You know, I mean, to say, how did you feel is enough, you know, because almost all these discussions, you've had people thinking of what to say. You know, I felt the denouement was more neoclassic than it was neorealistic. You know, fine. Where was the arc? You know, I've got the arc. But anyway, the immediacy of it is the second. But the third reason, the reason I do it most of all, and I'm sure you've discussed this, I think George mentioned you discussed this, is that it's just so damned unique, you know? I really believe the reason I don't go to much theater, the reason I don't like most theater is because it's nothing but television with a bigger screen. Most of the theater you'll see at the Rep, most of the theater you'll see anywhere. I'm doing a play now. I'm performing in a play. I'm rehearsing a play at ACT called Shadowlands. Beautifully written play, beautifully crafted play. But it could just as well be a movie and be a lot cheaper to go see. You could rent it. If you can get the experience just as well off TV or the movies, then why bother? I think the only way live theater will survive, and the only kind of theater I'm interested in, is theater that gives a unique experience to the audience. They cannot get it at the movies. They can't get it on cable. They can only get it in this room. They can only get it in live theater. If you've ever seen any of our plays, you know oftentimes there's a, of course I'm heavily influenced by children's theater, which I think is the hope of the world. And I you look at the children's theater. This is a place where changes can be made. I don't particularly want to do it anymore, but that's where I started. I did children's theater like for 7 years as an actor and director and writer, and it was the greatest learning experience of my life. Because it's so honest, and you're really trained, it really trains you on some great, deep, heart-of-heart, subconscious level to know when an audience is with you and when they're bored. And because it's just such a fragile thing with them, and it is with adults too, but they're too polite to show it. But you know, you tend to sense it if you've done 7 years of children's theater. But because of that, there's nothing like, I wrote a play in Atlanta called Appalachian Christmas. I actually developed it again with some real Appalachian people. And it was hugely popular because it was a Christmas show and people were sick of the Christmas Carol every year thing. And the people in it were wonderful, and I used to go every night just to watch the audience and the actors connect, to be in communion with each other. And I find it hard, God bless you, to miss that kind of, I find it hard when I miss that kind of communion when it's not there. Television and movies, I mean, it's great, but it's just not, there's nothing like it. That fullness, that oneness of you and the audience and connection. And to watch them laughing and crying and be one with, and then after the show, none of them leaving the theater, but coming in and talk to the actors and share their experiences. And one of the critics in Atlanta said, who didn't review it, said, well, I'm glad that I wasn't the reviewer of it because they needed the success, and what was the term he used? It's not what I would call theater. That's what it is. It's not what I would call theater. Well, in my opinion, it's exactly what I would call theater. It's exactly what it's supposed to be. I think if you're the kind of person who writes, have you seen the play of this Space, any of you? The Overmeyer piece? Really well written. But I think it would be better as a movie. I think you'd get the same experience as a movie. You don't have to do audience participation, you know, I mean, there's a lot of magic things about theater, but you know, even if it's just TV on the stage, there's still some communion going on, and that's nice, but I'm talking about as playwrights. You got the chance to really create whole new genres of art. And screenplay writers don't much have that chance. TV writers, well, with cable it helps a little, but generally don't. But as playwrights, you've got a chance to be the most creative artists in any kind of any kind of written form, I think. That's all I have to say. Any questions? See, I knew there would be. What's left after? No. Well, I think. Okay, you're adults, damn it. No, it's just too offensive. Okay, I'll tell you what it is. You have to kind of know the play. The play is this super macho detective down in the Bermuda Triangle looking for Joseph Mengele. And he's captured by Mengele and his assistant, who's a nun. I'm sorry, but I just... Anyway, and the nun is they've got them tied to a post. And they said, how did a woman like you ever get involved with this butcher, the white angel? Well, he calls him the blue angel because he's stupid. But anyway, says, and she says, well, I was in the, I have to lead up to this one. She says, I was in a convent after the war, and we hid out some Nazi war criminals. Which they did in convents after the war, monasteries a lot, and said, even that offends me. And Mengele came, we hid him, he was one of the war criminals we hid out, and he really touched something in me. So unfortunately, the bishop got wind of what he was touching and how often, and I was excommunicated. That isn't the one. And so, and said, but you know, there was something about him that attracted me. So my parents had always wanted me to be the doctor anyway. And this, and here's Dr. Joseph Mengele, and here's the line. He said he was powerful yet sensitive, the kind of man who could bring the world to its knees but not come in its mouth. That was a line. And see, it got generally that reaction. And most of the reactions, people like going, whoa, did she? And it was a nun, too, and that kind of sort of to be there. Any other intelligent questions? Yes.
What is it about hunchbacks?
You know, one of the fellows I work with, a fellow named Larry Larson, who now works for Ted Turner, is really into hunchbacks, and I don't know why. The hunchback and Hunchback of Notre Dame, of course, is there. Because he's there. But Larry, I met Larry doing children's theater in Atlanta. And every time we would develop a play, he always wanted to play somebody handicapped. I don't know why. Larry's a very athletic guy. He's very in great shape. But he always wanted to like play serious. Why don't I have leg braces in this? What don't I do? And when we originally wrote Tent Meeting, he had a character with leg braces, which thank God we finally got him out of that. But for some reason, when we wrote Illuminati, the idea, which is my favorite play of everything we've written, is the idea is that the assistant is deformed in some way. And the hunchback seemed like the best way, because spiritually he's incredibly whole and happy and wonderful. In fact, there's a great scene in Illuminati, the scene that's the biggest laugh in the play, where the Reverend, it's about, you ever read any of Red Illuminati or something? It's an American theater magazine. But anyway, it's about a priest, and it's kind of somewhere after the Holocaust, like these are the only two people left or something, and he's in this kind of bombed out church, and it's not going to sound like a comedy, but it is. And he's still keeps the form going, and he's threatened by these visions he keeps having that are undermining his faith. Meanwhile, he has this assistant, Brother Lawrence, who's a hunchback, who's also having visions. They're Gnostic visions, but he accepts them. Now, the Reverend Eddie, who's the priest, we see his visions, and we also play the characters in the visions. One vision is a guy applying for sainthood. You know, you got to have three miracles, you know. And the third miracle turns out he only has two miracles and he can't get in. And the guy said, I'm sorry, those are the rules. And so he's going to go back home, and he opens up his road map. He says, hey, where did you get that road map? He says, at the Sunoco station. He said, did you refold that map yourself? He said, yeah. So that's it. So then he lets him in. Then he has like one of those really big shank pictures. Pick his martyrdom, you know. And another one is where St. Paul and St. Timothy are making up the rules for women in the church that are right out of Paul's letters to Timothy in the Bible. And Paul is kind of like Paul Lynn, you know, we'll make up rules. They'll cover their heads. What for? It's a rule. And then there's various visions. In the end, he dies, and as he's dying, laying in his bed dying, Lawrence, the hunchback, is leaning over him, and Reverend Eddie's saying, if only I'd had the power that I asked God for, if only I could heal you, I could say, stand, Lawrence, stand and be straight. Stand and let your body behold, let the warm, healing light come into your body. And he's saying this, Lawrence is actually straightening up, and he comes to behold, and says, if only I could do this, and says, but I can't, and he snaps. So that's a good use of a hunchback. The blood orgy seemed to have natural to have a hunchback assistant. There's a hunchback, the macho guy has a hunchback assistant who speaks incomprehensibly. But you know, there's probably, this is what I mean by playwrights writing things that they don't know they're writing and why other people should direct them. A play, Tent Meeting, which is even a stranger play, much stranger play, but much more of a play. They teach it in a lot of colleges for some reason. We keep getting word back from people saying, I'm taking a course here at the University of Michigan, and they teach Tent Meeting. That actually made me feel the most valid as a playwright. When some girl came up to me once at a Shakespeare festival or something, and she said, excuse me, are you Mr. Lee? Are you Lee Lloyd? I said, yes. She said, I studied you in college. Oh, God. I'm Thornton Wilder. Anyway, at the University of Charleston, they teach a course in feminist religion, and they teach this play in the feminist religion, because the woman in the play, the daughter, is the one who is, generally in our plays about religion, and there's a lot of them about religion, there seem to always be the authority by the word, and the Gnostic character, the one who accepts with an open mind new ideas and new spiritual ideas, in a comedic way, generally. And she, and in the play, she removes the baby, her baby. She has a baby that has no eyes or ears or arms or legs or internal organs or anything, but lives and actually has magical powers. And at the end, they're going to kind of drown the baby, the father, in a baptism ceremony where they're going to baptize him as the new Jesus. And it, the last 20 minutes is a tent meeting with the audience. And that's where the audience participation in that comes. Singing hymns and shouting amen. And he opens with, there's an eggplant inside. She's been cooking eggplant all through the play. They're saying, not eggplant again. And inside, an eggplant rolls out. She has escaped with the baby. And in the very last scene of the play, she's on the road hitchhiking with the baby, glowing. You know. And at the University of Charleston, the College of Charleston, they're explaining why it's such a feminist play. One of the things is because the eggplant is a uterine vegetable. And you know, I started thinking about that, and we certainly did not say, let's use an eggplant. It's a uterine vegetable. What other uterine vegetables could we use? You know, but that doesn't mean it's not. You know, that doesn't mean that's not perfectly legitimate. You know, I encourage you, as a playwright, let me throw this out. I hope I don't go against anything that you're being taught. Rebel! I encourage you not to think for long periods of time. Just stop thinking, because it just gets in the way. There's a period in creativity, it's in group creativity and personal creativity, that I think you have to have called freewheeling thinking, where everything goes. You know, if your development can play with some people and you say, okay, now this scene, we all ride naked on a goat across the stage. If someone says you can't do that, well then, you know, you've cut off that road, you know. You may not gonna end up there, but the thing to do is to say, okay, then what? Then where do we go? Because you never know where you're gonna end up. There's other ways to get there. Once you end up, you don't have to, you know, maybe you want to ride naked. But the point is, when you're working on your own, if you start thinking about it too much, and if you start writing from here, you're just going to start censoring yourself. You're just going to censor feelings that should be on the page. You know, I got in an argument once with a woman after a play. It was a discussion. It was an argument. She was pretty hot.
We got to wrap up pretty soon. If you want to just tie it up.
I didn't mean to talk all this time, but I could have. About the play being sexist, you know. And I looked at it and said, yes, it is sexist. You're right. And it's something I need to work on in my personal life, but not in the play. You can't work it on the page, because then you just start censoring yourself. If you want your feelings to come out and you look at them and say, whoa, that's ugly. I didn't know I felt that. That's one thing. But you can't just start, you know, you can't. Work it out in your personal life, then let what comes out. It's good to examine yourself that way too. Yes, okay, thank you.
Great, thanks so much.
See you guys.
Bye, sir.